Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, when we talk about DNA, we usually are talking about genes, the bits that code for eye colour, height, disease risk and so on. But that's only a small part of the story. The other non-coding DNA has long been dismissed as junk until recently. Joining me to discuss is Dr. Kevin Mitchell, Associate Professor of Genetics and Neuroscience at Trinity College Dublin. Hi, Kevin. Good to have you back. It's been a while.
Thanks for having me.
This junk DNA, just give us the... Give us the makeup of DNA that we consider to be useful in doing stuff like making before we get to that DNA it's a molecule tightly wound in each cell and it gives instructions to make different cells do different things. Is that essentially right?
Yeah. So basically, the DNA is the physical stuff that is the genetic material that pretty much has the instructions to make a whole organism what it is, right? So a dog is a dog, develops as a dog because it has dog DNA, and a cat has cat DNA and so on. So within that, so the DNA is basically a long molecule that's broken up into the various chromosomes, and along those chromosomes...
Just pause on that for a second. So the chromosome, are they... Because when we see them on a page, they're all separate and floaty.
Yeah.
Are they separate and floaty?
Yeah, so they come in like... There's 23 pairs of chromosomes. So you can think of the human genome as basically the full sequence of all of those chromosomes. So you start at the start of chromosome 1, you go to the end of that, and you go to chromosome 2 and so on. It's basically a single line of letters, A, C, G, and T and so on.
But in reality, they're floaty bits of 23 little bits of DNA.
Yeah, exactly. But it's kind of arbitrary the way that they're broken up into those chromosomes, and different species break them up in different ways.
Right,
they get
okay.
all jumbled around. So along the chromosome, what you'll find is certain sections of DNA that code for a protein. And what that means is the sequence of DNA bases specifies the sequence of what are called amino acids, which are the components of proteins. So you could think of a protein like hemoglobin or collagen or liver enzymes or neurotransmitter receptors. We've got about 20,000 different proteins, and they do the jobs in different cells. Right? Now, the tricky thing is that different cells need to make different proteins. So they all have the same genes. Those genes code for those proteins, but they don't make them all, right?
Yeah.
So we need liver enzymes in our liver cells, and we need hemoglobin in our red blood cells, and so on. So each cell has a profile of genes that it's expressing, and that's what makes it that cell, right?
Right.
So the bits that code for proteins are really easy to identify.
Why?
Well, for one thing, the sequence, you can translate the sequence into the language of amino acids, and you can see that it makes a protein. And then you can compare that between species. So if I look at the hemoglobin sequence in my genome and compare that to a dog genome or a cat genome, it's almost identical. Like, the proteins look almost identical, right? In fact, most of the proteins between, you know, closely related species are pretty much the same. You could even swap them out with each other. They do the same job.
So, but you can't necessarily swap out DNA, but you can swap out proteins.
You could swap out the piece of DNA that codes for the protein, even from, say, a human into a fruit fly. So there's a protein in flies that if you delete it, the flies have no eyes.
Oh.
You can take the human protein, the gene encoding the human protein, a little stretch of DNA, put it into the fly, and it'll make an eye again. So the protein,
a human eye?
No, it'll make a fly eye, right? So the protein itself is pretty much conserved. So then you have to ask, well, what's the difference then between these different species? What's making them different? And that's where this other element of DNA coding comes in, and it's these other bits of DNA that control when you make a protein and which cell you make it in and how much you make it. And those bits of DNA vary a lot between species. So it's like we all have the same letters, right? They all have the same alphabet. We're just putting them together in different ways, right? So, you know, you put the same words together in different ways, you get Romeo and Juliet or The Lord of the Rings, right?
Right. So there are some parts of the DNA that are specifically just for controlling, make more of this, do it now, stop making that.
Exactly.
What are they called?
They're called enhancer sequences.
And enhancer sequences.
They're tricky because they're tricky to identify. They don't tend to be as conserved in their sequence. So you can't just compare across different species and pick them out that way so easily.
Why?
it's a little complicated, but they function by being like a landing site for other proteins. So some proteins make the stuff that cells need to do whatever their specific job is. But then there's another set of proteins that are regulators, and their job is just to regulate all of the other genes. And they do that by binding to these enhancer sequences in a very sequence-specific way. And then when they bind, they activate production of the gene that they're near to.
When I see visualizations of this on YouTube or scientific TV, there's a lot of sort of sticking together and ripping apart.
Yeah.
And these are presumably chemical and physical forces.
Exactly.
That essentially, almost like magnets, they're sort of flying around, they zip up together and they de-zip and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they don't, it's not like there's no they don't design themselves to do that, but that's kind of what's happening in the cell. There's a lot of mush out there, and then when something's happening, it sort of exposes a sticky area, and then there's a certain thing that'll stick onto that. Is that kind of how our cells work?
Yeah, very much so. It's a jitty, jiggery, wet mess in there, right? This is not like electronic engineering.
Because on the page, it looks so clean and pristine.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a perfect one of those machines that, you know, that you get a box and just slides perfectly into the desk and you can't see the, you know, there's no satisfying perfection in the cell.
Exactly. So super messy, very complicated, very noisy in an engineering sense. And what the cell and the organism has to do is marshal all of that noise and kind of, in a statistical sense, get the right genes to get turned on in the right cells. So that gene I mentioned before, that when you mutate it in flies, they don't develop eyes, that's a regulator protein. And what it does is bind the DNA, these enhancer sequences, of a bunch of other genes and turn them on. And those are the genes that you physically need to make an eye with all the right cells and doing all the right functions.
Okay.
So you have these regulator genes, there's thousands of them in our genome, and then these sort of structural effector genes that are doing the job of different cell types. And so if you start to then think about when you have mutations, that is variations in the DNA sequence, that, as you said, can contribute to our traits, contribute to diseases and so on, then as geneticists, what we're trying to do is find those, right? And so the easy ones to find are the ones that just knock out, just completely destroy the coding sequence of a protein. So, for example, hemoglobin, there's mutations in that gene that are the cause of sickle cell anemia.
Yeah.
Right? So the gene for sickle cell anemia is really a mutation in the stretch of DNA that codes for the protein hemoglobin, makes it not work properly. Okay. Those ones have been kind of easy to find, but there's loads of other genetic variations around there that we know contribute to disease because we can map them. They're more frequent in people with a disease than without, but they don't affect the coding sequence of a protein.
Right.
So people have been trying to find out what they do, and it turns out that many of them affect these enhancer sequences. So they affect the regulation of other genes in this really sort of subtle, complicated way where there's loads and loads of them contributing to disease risk all at the same time. That poses a challenge.
And so where does junk DNA fit into all of this?
Yeah, so the junk DNA was a sort of a pejorative term that was used to refer to all of the DNA that wasn't coding for proteins. And the coding sequence is only actually about 2% of the genome.
2%?
Yeah. So as you're scanning along a chromosome, just every once in a while, you'll come across a bit that actually codes for a protein. And then there might be thousands and thousands of bases of DNA that don't, right?
And so there presumably that other 98% isn't regulating the coding protein.
Yeah, not all of it. So some of it is. Some of it is these enhancer sequences. And actually, we don't know how much, but it's probably a lot.
Okay.
So there's millions and millions of these enhancer sequences.
Which would make sense because that how these proteins actually get made, how the genes get expressed, the timing of all that, that gives us a banana or it gives us, you know, Donald Trump.
Exactly. And it's super, super complicated, right? If you think about the number of cell types in a human body, it's many, many, many thousands of different cell types that all have to be put together in the right way. So, but actually a lot of the genome is just leftover like retroviruses and genomic parasites.
What do you mean?
So viruses, some viruses, when they infect cells, make a copy of their genome and insert it into the chromosome of the host. And then it just lives there, right? And so our genome is littered with the corpses of retroviruses and what are called transposable elements, these little bits of DNA that that are kind of like parasites that copy themselves and jump around in the genome.
But hang on a second. I was taught in biology that, you know, the copying mechanism of DNA is so precise and so perfect that we can't mimic it almost in technology, that it's that perfect to create copies of itself over and over again. How on earth could we tolerate sort of crusty old virus DNA hanging around? Why does our body tolerate that?
Well, so in many cases, if it lands, you know, if it inserts itself in the middle of one of our protein coding genes, it won't be tolerated, right? It'll cause a disease or malfunction of that protein. But if it lands in between genes, then it's sort of in an area that's not doing anything, right? Huh. So it can be tolerated, and it's hard to get rid of. Like, we don't have a mechanism to get rid of them. We do have mechanisms in our cells to stop them proliferating and jumping around. So actually, there's a whole like genome defense set of proteins that we have. Their sole job is to try and stop these viruses and transposable elements. But you know, it's not perfect. So all of our genomes are basically riddled with these things, and they make up a huge proportion of our total genome.
Is it possible that that some of these viruses led to mutations or changes in the way a cell worked that actually led to, you know, positive evolution, but the evolution of the species?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. I'm trying to think of any particular examples. I think there are some. It would be a very rare kind of of situation, right? But anytime you make a change to, say, the way a protein is regulated, most of the time, most changes that you could make are just going to be bad. And the reason for that is that evolution has been at this for millions of years, has tried to perfect and optimize everything. And you're just going in there at random. It's like sticking a screwdriver in a Ferrari engine. You're just not very likely to improve things, right? But every once in a while, you go in, you tighten one nut, and it turns out you get slightly better performance. So it's possible that that can happen. There probably are examples of that. I just don't know them. But the fact that the genome is full of these sort of repeated elements does mean that it's a little easier for it to evolve.
I'm conscious of time, but I wanted to ask this one final question. How do we not know which parts of the DNA are these organizing genes and which are not just useless or doing something else?
So there's some amazing efforts that people are making these days to try and find these, and there's actually been really huge progress. In fact, a paper just published this week, actually, showing a huge resource cataloging millions and millions of these enhancer sequences and then tying them to expression in particular cell types. Right, so that becomes really key then, because if you're thinking about a disease, you can find a genetic variant that affects expression in one particular cell type or another, and that can tell you something about the biology of the disease.
Right. Okay. So yeah, because you know, when you hear about the human genome being mapped, you think, oh, well, we know exactly what's in the genome, but there's more research required. It seems. Thanks very much, Kevin.
Thank you.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.